Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 109, but who's counting? It's Monday, April 12th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, of course, COVID-19 still seems to be dominating the public health news, but we'll get to some non-COVID news later. Okay, I haven't reported on cell phone tracking data for mobility, which is one way to estimate how well we're doing with, you know, social distancing and not concentrating in large crowds and that type of thing. And I would say that I've been keeping an eye on that, and it looks like the United States as a whole is doing a pretty good job. With all the talk of COVID fatigue, we still seem to have learned some things and are sticking to it. But of course, it looks like these more easily transmitted and more deadly variants are physically changing the playing field that we are on. So the race between the variants and the vaccines continue. But I'd really like to focus on the big picture and the long game. In the opening segment, I'd like to call, It's a Pandemic, Stupid. Of course, in public health, part of what the public in public health is that we have a shared fate, that there's a collective common reality that we share, and that we need to be good neighbors to one another. And public health is a long game, and playing the short game, you may be good at playing the short game, but it may not produce the longest results. So let's start with some international, worldwide, planetary news. This from the Hill. World Health Organization warns global COVID-19 pandemic is, quote, growing exponentially. Top World Health Organization officials today warned against complacency in fighting COVID-19 amid a troubling spike in cases worldwide. There were 4.4 million new cases recorded in the last week, said Maria von Kerkhove, the World Health Organization's technical lead for COVID-19, the seventh week in a row of increasing cases. That's compared to about 500,000 cases per week a year ago. Deaths have been rising for 4 weeks. Okay, I'm going to say that again. 4.4 million new cases in the last week compared to 500,000 cases per week a year ago, early in the epidemic. So, are we making progress, or are we actually in a worse place than we were a year ago as a planet? So in the U.S., there might be cause for optimism, but remember, we're embedded in a pandemic. Okay, on with the story. This is not the situation we wanted to be in 16 months into a pandemic where we have proven control measures, she added. It is time right now we're doing where everyone has to take stock and have a reality check about what we need to be doing. Okay, and this from Medical Express. No region the world spared as virus cases and deaths surge. Hospitals in Turkey and Poland are filling up. Pakistan is restricting domestic travel. The U.S. government will send more help to the state with the country's worst infection increase. The worldwide surge in coronavirus cases and deaths includes even Thailand, which has weathered the pandemic far better than many nations, but now struggles to contain COVID-19. The World Health Organization said infection rates are climbing in every global region, driven by new virus variants and too many countries coming out of lockdown too soon. We've seen rises in cases worldwide for 6 weeks, and now, sadly, we are seeing rises in deaths for the last 3 weeks, Dr. Margaret Harris, a World Health Organization spokesman, said at a briefing in Geneva. In its weekly epidemiological update, the World Health Organization said over 4 million COVID-19 cases reported in the last week. New deaths increased by 11% compared to last week, with over 71,000 deaths reported worldwide. The increasing infections, hospitalizations, and deaths extend to countries where vaccinations are finally gaining momentum. That leaves even bleaker prospects for much of the world, where large-scale vaccination programs remain a more distant prospect. In Turkey, which is among the badly hit countries, most new cases of the virus can be traced to a variant first found in Brazil. Ismail Sinel, head of the Turkish Intensive Care Association, said the surge was beginning to strain the nation's relatively advanced healthcare system, and that, quote, the alarm bells are ringing for intensive care units, which are not yet at full capacity. The mutant form of the virus is causing more harm to the organs, Sinel said. While 2 out of patients were dying previously, the number is now 4 out of 10. And if we continue this way, we'll lose 6 out of 10. In Brazil, which has the second highest death toll in the world after the U.S., Sao Paulo has started night burials to cope with demand, and school vans have been used to transport coffins. With the pace of vaccination already slow, less than 3% of Brazil's 210 million people have received both vaccine doses. Some governors have expressed concern about vaccine supplies. The death toll in Iran is also rising, prompting new restrictions that will take effect for 10 days in 257 cities that began last Saturday. They involve the closure of all parks, restaurants, confectionaries, beauty salons, malls, and bookstores. Authorities in Pakistan, which is in the middle of a third surge of infections, are restricting inner-city transportation on weekends starting at midnight. Elsewhere in Asia, authorities in Thailand ordering new restrictions last Friday in an effort to contain a growing coronavirus outbreak just days before the traditional New Year's holiday when millions of people travel. Poland is also seeing a dramatic spike in deaths, and hospitals have been forced to turn away cancer and other patients as ICU and other hospital beds are taken by COVID-19 patients. Hospitalization of virus patients there have jumped 20% in the past 2 weeks. Harris from the World Health Organization said the world knows how to fight these surges. She cited good news from the UK, where new coronavirus cases dropped 60% in March amid a strong vaccination program. But we have to do it all. We have to keep on social distancing. We have to avoid indoor crowded settings, she said. We have to keep wearing masks, even if vaccinated. Okay, well, if we think that young people are much, much, much less likely to get COVID and it's going to be a problem if we... won't be a problem if we vaccinate the most vulnerable people, then maybe this lesson we can learn from Brazil. This from Medical Express. Brazil now has more young than old COVID patients in ICUs. The number of COVID-19 patients under 40 in intensive care in Brazil surpassed older groups last month amid a deadly surge driven partly by a new coronavirus variant. The number of people aged 39 or younger in intensive care units with COVID-19 in March rose sharply to more than 11,000, or 52% of the total, said the Brazilian ICU project. The patients arriving in ICUs now are younger, have no pre-existing conditions, and are developing more severe cases of the virus too. The number of ICU patients without pre-existing conditions increased by nearly a third in March to 30% of the total. And the proportion of patients put on ventilators reached a pandemic record of 58% in March, according to the project's data. So if we were hoping that the impact of the severity of this disease would be wildly reduced by moving into younger populations, that may be true with the original virus, but with these variants, which are moving in this country all around the world, trouble is still brewing. And this includes developed countries as well. This from the Associated Press. Japan imposes new virus measures in Tokyo ahead of Olympics. Japan announced last Friday that it will raise the coronavirus alert level in Tokyo to allow tougher measures to curb the rapid spread of a more contagious variant ahead of the Summer Olympics. The steps come less than 3 weeks after the emergency was lifted for Tokyo, underscoring the difficulty of balancing antivirus measures and the economy. The government has been criticized for being too slow in enacting antivirus measures out of a reluctance to further damage the pandemic-hit economy. Just over 1 million people in Japan, or less than 1% of the population, have received the first of two doses of vaccine, and the surge in cases may cause further cancellations of Olympic-related events. And of course, what's happening around the world is putting pressure on the Biden administration. This from The Hill. Biden eyes bigger U.S. role in global vaccination efforts. The Biden administration is taking initial steps toward an expanded role in global COVID-19 vaccination efforts, while stopping short of sharing excess doses on a wide scale. The federal government has been amassing doses, growing its supply into what will likely become a surplus as the rest of the world struggles with shortages. In fact, the U.S. has purchased enough vaccines to immunize every adult in the country three times over. Aid groups now say it's past time to start giving away the surplus. The administration, however, remains hesitant to do so. Most of the U.S. international support has come in the form of money, with the administration committing $4 billion to the World Health Organization-backed COVAX vaccine initiative. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said he has been hearing the calls to share doses. In response to those calls, he announced the appointment of Gail Smith as U.S. Coordinator for Global COVID-19 Response and Health Security. Smith was most recently served as President and CEO of the One Campaign, a nonpartisan organization that advocates for ending poverty and preventable diseases by 2030. The One Campaign has been pressuring the administration to ship some of its vaccine supply to developing countries. Late last month, the group joined a coalition of 30 non-governmental organizations in sending a letter to Biden, urging him to immediately begin to develop a plan to share excess vaccine doses. It is estimated there could be twice as many deaths from COVID-19 if rich countries monopolize the first doses of vaccines instead of making sure they are distributed globally, the groups wrote. The president remains committed to playing a constructive role in the global effort to defeat the virus, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said last Friday. But, as we've seen, this is an unpredictable virus, and his first priority is ensuring the American people are vaccinated, and that means we need to plan for supply. So, of course, the America First approach, perhaps not too surprisingly, is continuing to a large extent. Next up, also from Associated Press, stalled at first jab, vaccine shortages hit poor countries. As many as 60 countries, including some of the world's poorest, might be stalled at the first shots of their coronavirus vaccinations because nearly all deliveries through the global program intended to help them are blocked until as late as June. COVAX, a global initiative to provide vaccines to countries lacking the clout to negotiate for scarce supplies on their own, has in the past week shipped more than 25,000 doses to low-income countries only twice on any given day. Deliveries have all but halted since last Monday. During the past 2 weeks, according to data compiled by UNICEF, fewer than 2 million COVAX doses in total were cleared for shipment to 92 countries in the developing world, the same amount injected in Britain alone. Last Friday, the head of the World Health Organization slammed the shocking imbalance in global COVID-19 vaccination. The World Health Organization director said that while 1 in 4 people in rich countries had received a vaccine, only 1 in 500 people in poor countries had gotten a dose. The vaccine shortage stems mostly from India's decision to stop exporting vaccines from its Serum Institute factory, which produces the overwhelming majority of the AstraZeneca doses that COVAX counted on to supply around a third of the global population at a time coronavirus is spiking worldwide. COVAX will only ship vaccines cleared by the World Health Organization, and countries are increasingly impatient. Supplies are dwindling in some of the first countries to receive COVAX shipments, and the expected delivery of second doses in the 12-week window currently recommended is now in doubt. In a statement, the vaccine alliance known as Gavi told the Associated Press that 60 countries are affected by the delays. Internal World Health Organization documents obtained by the Associated Press show the uncertainty about deliveries is, quote, causing some countries to lose faith in the COVAX effort. That is prompting the World Health Organization to consider speeding up its endorsement of vaccines from China and Russia, which have not been authorized by any regulators in Europe or North America. The World Health Organization documents show that UN agency is facing questions from COVAX participants about allotments, in addition to uncertainty about whether all those who were vaccinated in round one are even guaranteed a second dose. The WHO said last month it might be possible to greenlight the Chinese vaccines by the end of April. Some experts have noted that Sinopharm and Sinovac, two Chinese-made vaccines, lack published data, and there are reports of people needing a third dose to be protected. If there is something that we miss from not having thoroughly evaluated the risk of adverse events from these vaccines, that would undermine the confidence in all the good products that we're using that we know are safe, said Dora Curry, Director of Health Equity and Rights at CARE International. Other experts worried that delays could erode faith in governments that were particularly efficient in their vaccination programs and were counting on second doses soon. In the absence of high vaccination coverage globally, we risk dragging out the pandemic for several more years, said Lavanya Vasuvadin, an assistant professor at Duke University's Global Health Initiative. Every day that the virus is in circulation is an opportunity for it to mutate into a more deadly variant. Earlier this month, the WHO appealed to rich countries to urgently share 10 million doses to meet the UN target of starting COVID-19 vaccinations in every country within the first 100 days of the year. So far, countries have pledged hundreds of millions of dollars to COVAX, but there are simply no doses to buy, and no country has agreed to immediately share what it has. No country has agreed to immediately share what it has. Okay, there we go. Bilateral donations of doses tend to go along political lines rather than to countries with the most infections, and they aren't nearly enough to compensate for the goals that COVAX has set out. Think Global Health, a data site managed by the Council on Foreign Relations, identified 19 countries that have donated a total of 27.5 million doses to 102 nations as of last Thursday. You can make a strong argument that we're better off making donations in crisis and getting the pandemic under control than vaccinating low-risk groups at home, said Thomas Bolake, director of the Global Health Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. Bolake said COVAX was both a great disappointment and the only available option for most of the world. According to the International Rescue Committee, COVID-19 cases and deaths last month surged in numerous crisis-hit countries by 322% in Kenya, 379% in Yemen, and 529% in northeast Syria. Last Thursday, the agencies behind COVAX, the WHO, the Vaccines Alliance's Gavi and CEPI, a coalition for epidemic preparedness, celebrated the delivery of 38 million life-saving vaccinations to more than 100 countries. Brooke Baker, a vaccines expert at Northeastern University, said the laudatory message was misplaced. Quote, celebrating doses sufficient for only 19 million people, or 0.25% of global population, is tone deaf, he said, adding it was time for the WHO and partners to be more honest with countries. The WHO and Gavi have repeatedly overpromised and underdelivered, so why should we believe that they will suddenly be able to ramp up production and deliveries in a couple of months, he said. And next up, in a related story from Medical Express, pursuing global maximum suppression of COVID. At the end of 2020, there was a strong hope that high levels of vaccination would see humanity finally gain the upper hand over SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. In an ideal scenario, the virus would then be contained at very low levels without further societal disruption or significant numbers of deaths. But since then, new variants of concern have emerged and spread worldwide, putting current pandemic control efforts, including vaccination, at risk of being derailed. Put simply, the game has changed, and a successful global rollout of current vaccines by itself is no longer a guarantee of victory. No one is truly safe from COVID-19 until everyone is safe. We are in a race against time to set global transmission rates low enough to prevent the emergence and spread of new variants. The danger is that variants will arise that can overcome the immunity conferred by vaccinations or prior infection. What's more, many countries lack the capacity to track emerging variants via genomic surveillance. This means the situation may be even more serious than it appears. As members of the Lancet COVID-19 Commission Task Force on Public Health, we call for urgent action in response to the new variants. These new variants mean we cannot rely on the vaccines alone to provide protection, but must maintain strong public health measures to reduce the risk from these variants. At the same time, we need to accelerate the vaccine program in all countries in an equitable way. Together, these strategies will deliver, quote, maximum suppression of the virus. Genetic mutations of viruses like SARS-CoV-2 emerge frequently, but some variants are labeled variants of concern because they can reinfect people who have had previous infection or vaccination, or are more transmissible or can lead to more severe disease. For these reasons, reducing community transmission is vital. No single action is sufficient to prevent the virus's spread. We must maintain strong public health measures in tandem with vaccination programs in every country. Why we need maximum suppression. Each time the virus replicates, there's an opportunity for a mutation to occur. And as we are already seeing around the world, some of the resulting variants risk eroding the effectiveness of vaccines. That's why we have called for a global strategy of maximum suppression. Public health leaders should focus on efforts that maximally suppress viral infection rates, thus helping to prevent the emergence of mutations that can become new variants of concern. Prompt vaccine rollouts alone will not be enough to achieve this. Continued public health measures such as face masks and physical distancing will be vital too. Ventilation of indoor spaces is important, some of which is under people's control, some of which will require adjustments to buildings. Fair access to vaccines. Global equity in vaccine access is vital too. High-income countries should support multilateral mechanisms such as the COVAX facility, donate excess vaccines to low- and middle-income countries, and support increased vaccine production. However, to prevent the emergence of viral variants of concern, it may be necessary to prioritize countries or regions with the highest disease prevalence and transmission levels, where the risk of such variants emerging is greatest. Health systems must be better prepared against future variants. Suppression efforts should be accompanied by genomic surveillance programs to identify and quickly characterize emerging variants in as many countries as possible around the world. Rapid large-scale second-generation vaccine programs and increased production capacity that can support equity in vaccine distribution. Studies of vaccine effectiveness on existing and new variants of concern. Adapting public health measures such as double masking and recommitting to health systems arrangements such as ensuring personal protective equipment for health staff. Behavioral, environmental, social, and systems interventions such as enabling ventilation, distancing between people, and an effective find, test, trace, isolate, and support system. COVID-19 variants of concern have changed the game. We need to recognize and act on this if we as a global society are to avoid future waves of infections, yet more lockdowns and restrictions, and avoidable illness and death. Okay, one more story to drive all this home from the LA Times. Double mutant coronavirus variant is found in California. A possible worrisome variant of the coronavirus first identified in India, so new that it has no official name, has been found in California by scientists at Stanford University. Nicknamed the double mutant variant by the BBC and others, the variant is sparking concern among some scientists because it contains not just one, but two worrisome mutations in its genetic composition that have been identified among other variants of concern being tracked by the CDC. We don't know how these two mutations behave when they're paired together, Dr. Benjamin Pinsky, director of the Clinical Virology Laboratory at Stanford, said in an interview. The existence of the newly discovered variant was first disclosed by India's government on March 24th. Pinsky said, after a surge of coronavirus cases was detected in the nation's second most populous state, Maharashtra, whose largest city is Mumbai, the new variant is responsible for roughly 15-20% of new coronavirus cases there. Why this new variant may be worrisome? None of the other variants being monitored by federal officials had the same combination of these two mutations, known as L452R and E484Q, the latter of which is closely related to a more well-known mutation known as E484K. The L452R mutation became well-known in California, is one found in the California variant, resulting in a strain that is believed to make the virus more infectious and might cause reduced immunity in people who have been vaccinated. The E484Q mutation is closely related to the E48K mutation, which has been found in variants first identified in South Africa, Brazil, and New York. The E484K mutation is also concerning because it might give the virus the ability to partly evade the immune system's protective response among inoculated people or those who have survived a conventional COVID-19 infection. What we don't know is how these two mutations will behave when they're put in the same virus, Pinsky said. There's a reasonable amount of information about these two mutations individually, but will it be worse if they're together? We don't really know how they're going to interact. A potential nightmare scenario could result from the spread of variants like the kind that struck Brazil. The city of Manaus was one of the hardest hit in the world with a conventional strain of the coronavirus, and it now appears that there's a lot of substantial reinfection with the new Brazilian variant. Dr. Stefano Bertozzi, professor of health policy and dean emeritus of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health, said at a UC San Francisco forum last month. However, immunity produced by vaccines is believed to be better than immunity produced by surviving COVID-19. And while some variants are believed to result in a slight reduction of the effectiveness of some vaccines, some experts say that reduction equates to only mild to moderate illness. And I would take this opportunity to plug the bonus articles that I put online. One long read that gets at this is Brazil has become South America's super spreader. And basically, they're talking about Latin America. So when you combine Brazil and U.S., the two largest countries in the Western Hemisphere, both of which performed poorly, this equals the Western Hemisphere being over twice as much as affected as the rest of the world. We are not doing that well. You can read that article and others, which I will highlight at the end of the program, at toppun.com/blog/WAKT.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, let's get to the local COVID-19 update. This has to be understood in the context that Michigan is the epicenter of the U.S. epidemic and is bearing down on us heavily, literally, moving south. And we are in the way. Okay, well, the average number of daily cases over the last week in Lucas County rose to 136 a day. This is almost double to what it was 4 or 5 weeks ago and heading up steadily. And 69 of 88 Ohio counties are still in high incidence transmission. This is 5 more counties than last week. So we reversed course where we were adding or deleting counties from the high incidence category, but now we're adding them back in. We are going the wrong direction in the state of Ohio. In Lucas County, the test positivity rate, that is people that get tested at what percentage of them actually test positive, this has moved up to 11.1% from 10.0% the week before. And this has increased in the last month or month and a half from a low of 5.7%. and seems to be heading steadily up. This is true for the state as a whole, which bumped up to 4.6% for the test positivity rate, up from 4.2% the week before, and from a low about 5 or 6 weeks ago of 3%. Still below the 5% that considers that you have a decent level of testing. So statewide, we're still managing to stay with that, but we're moving the wrong direction. Okay, nursing homes, what have been a success story, it looks like that trend is reversing as well, where we had 38 active cases at 16 residents and 22 staff. And that 38 is the highest we've had in the last 6 or 7 weeks, and a trend that has been going up slowly but steadily for the last month. And on that note, for long-term care facilities, I want to do this story from WCPO in Cincinnati. The Ohio Department of Health broke state public records law by not releasing nursing home COVID-19 deaths special master rules. WCPO and other media outlets have been fighting for more transparency for nearly a year against state health officials who refuse to say how many residents die of COVID-19 at each nursing home. Other states such as Kentucky, Indiana, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and West Virginia open and release this information to the public. The Ohio Department of Health ignored it, said WCPO's attorney Jack Greiner. They just ignored that provision of the law, and they were called out for it by the special master. While the Ohio Department of Health does release a number of COVID-19 cases at each long-term care facility on its website, it only lists the number of COVID deaths at the county level, not by facility. Last summer, when WCPO first made its public records request, 70% of all Ohio COVID-19 deaths were patients of long-term care facilities. State officials were scrambling to control the pandemic by conducting mass testing of nursing home residents and staff. Anytime you can delay the release of information, you sort of inherently reduce the news value of it, Greiner said. It's no longer really news. Now it's kind of history. And of course, surveillance is really important in public health, both for the professionals overlooking and the public as a whole. And we don't want our surveillance to be a study in history. We want it to happen in real time. Shame on you, Ohio Department of Health. Hopefully you can do better in the future. Thanks for the lawsuit, WCPO. Okay, well, back to the local update. New hospitalizations are trending up in both Lucas County and Ohio in the last week. Lucas County death rate over the last 14 days, we've only had 6 deaths, and this is lower than the state and national death rate, so that's good. Hopefully there'll be a nice long lag from cases to deaths, but we're seeing hospitalizations go up, so deaths are probably in the pipeline. UT doing its surveillance has had an uptick, the highest it's had in 4 or 5 weeks, with 23 cases identified. Their surveillance testing had 0.9% positivity. That's the random testing that they've done, which is relatively low, but a little higher than they've had in recent weeks. And for Lucas County schools, we had a record low of 12 identified infections. That's only 1 staff person and 11 students. So that's good news and probably related to the fact that a lot of school employees have been vaccinated, which leads to this next story. This from Medical Express. Nearly 8 in 10 school and childcare staff have gotten at least 1 dose of COVID vaccine. In findings that bode well for the full reopening of schools across America, a new government survey shows that nearly 80% of school employees and childcare workers have received at least 1 dose of a coronavirus vaccine. Congratulations, America! And on the vaccine front as a whole, the U.S., Ohio, and Lucas County are around 35 or 36% of people who have received at least 1 dose. As you may know, I've been tracking the racial ethnic disparity of vaccinations, and Lucas County has edged up a measly 2%, so that now blacks in Lucas County are 48% as likely as whites to have been vaccinated, so that's less than half as likely. It's bumped up a couple percent also in Ohio, up to 55%. So Lucas County is doing a little worse than Ohio as a whole for racial ethnic disparities in vaccinations. Of course, if you're still not vaccinated, it's open up to everybody age 16 and above in Ohio, and you can go to gettheshot.coronavirus.ohio.gov to find out where it's available and set up an appointment. If you need language assistance or you have poor internet access, you can call 211 locally. If you're over 65, you can call the Area Office of Aging for assistance, 419-382-0624. Or Lucas County residents can visit any library branch to schedule an appointment or call 419 859-5200. You are listening to Just for the Health of It, the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. This is WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. Okay, well, in the last couple months, I've talked a lot about the advantage and importance of prioritizing vaccinations to the highest risk people. And we have this from Science Daily. Vaccinating seniors, essential workers first, offers greatest public health benefits, study shows. Waiting for your turn can be frustrating, especially when it comes to COVID-19 vaccinations. But prioritizing who receives a limited supply of vaccines available saves lives and reduces spread of infection, according to a study published in the journal PNAS from the University of California, Davis. For the study, the researchers modeled COVID-19 transmission rates and the optimal allocation of an initially limited vaccine supply in the U.S. under a variety of scenarios. They found that deaths, years of life lost, and infections were between 17 to 44% lower when vaccinations targeted vulnerable populations, particularly seniors and essential workers, rather than an alternative approach where everyone is equally likely to be vaccinated. We also found in regions where there was a faster increase in infections and where there is less masking and social distancing occurring, targeting was even more important in avoiding those outcomes, said lead author Jack Buckner. Building on the standard approach in modeling analysis to account for age groups, the study is the first to include frontline essential workers as their own category. In doing so, the researchers identified that such workers should be a vaccination priority along with or shortly after seniors. Policies that target based on both age and essential worker status substantially outperform those that consider age only. There is a substantial value to prioritization, at least for the first few months of the vaccine rollout, Springborn said. Once a large proportion of the most vulnerable people or the most likely to be exposed have been vaccinated, it becomes less important to who gets it, said Buckner. Of course, places that have opened up vaccination can still prioritize vaccinating by directing resources to those that are higher risk, such as identified in this study. Okay, well, this next story from Stat News gets at the fact that the Biden administration doesn't look like surging vaccines to hard-hit areas is a strategy they're going to do at the time. Biden officials rebuff appeals to surge COVID-19 vaccine to Michigan amid growing crisis. Amid Michigan's worst-in-the-nation coronavirus surge, scientists and public health officials are urging the Biden administration to flood the state with additional vaccine doses. So far, though, their plea has fallen on deaf ears. Instead, the federal government is sticking to a vaccine allocation strategy that largely awards doses to states and territories based on their population. As a result, most jurisdictions are still receiving similar per capita vaccine supplies, regardless of how many people are getting sick or how many excess vaccine doses they have. Experts have cast a surge in Michigan's vaccine supply as a critical tool in combating the state's most recent COVID-19 crisis. The state is currently recording nearly 7,000 new cases per day, just shy of its all-time peak in December. Hospitalizations and deaths, which tend to lag a few weeks behind increasing case counts, are also on the rise. I would be surging a lot of vaccines to Michigan right now, said Ashish Jha, the dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. To me, this is a no-brainer policy, and I would be curious to hear why the Biden team hasn't done this. During a media briefing last Wednesday, White House officials acknowledged that Michigan's situation is dire. They gave no indication, though, that they would send additional vaccines there to help quell the surge. They argue that it is too early in the national vaccine campaign to begin targeting supply based on case rates. Rochelle Walensky, the director of the CDC, said the agency was working to expand testing capacity in the state, address outbreaks in Michigan's jails and prisons, and scale up genomic sequencing. The one strategy should not bring up was scaling up vaccine supply. Some have attempted to quantify what's at stake more precisely. One modeler, University of California Berkeley research programmer Joshua Schwab, recently projected that doubling Michigan's vaccine allocation for 2 weeks could prevent 10,000 hospitalizations and 1,200 deaths. Even as the broader vaccination campaign continues to accelerate, however, momentum has built for surging vaccines to hotspots. The debate in Michigan mirrors one in New Jersey, which experts have argued should also receive additional vaccine supply. Federal officials have similarly ignored that request. 4 months into the U.S. vaccination effort, though vaccine supply is far less tight. There are states like Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana, Utah, where throughout much of the day the vaccine appointments are going unfilled, Jha said. What all of us are arguing for the next couple of weeks, surge a ton of vaccines to Michigan. And if certain states that have plenty of supply get a 25% lower allotment for 2 weeks, they probably won't miss it. Then get them back to their normal level and catch them up if they need it. Well, I think this is a good example of the simplicity of doing it by population. And by simplicity, I mean the difficulty in expending political capital in being viewed as potentially being favorites of one state or another. For instance, Michigan is a blue state and has had a lot of controversy and pushback. So I would say, you know, when the Biden administration says it wants to follow the science and that's all they're going to do, to be honest, they have to say it's not just the science of epidemiology and public health. It is political science as well. They're definitely making calculations that isn't based simply on the hard science of it. They have to look at the soft science of political science. Very complicated, the world we live in. Of course, around here, we favor the hard science. Show me the numbers. And while vaccine eligibility is opened up to everybody, we don't want to forget about the elderly, the most vulnerable. This from Associated Press. Summoning seniors, big new push to vaccinate older Americans. About 76% of Americans age 65 and older have received at least one shot of the COVID-19 vaccine since authorization in December, according to the CDC. But the rate of new vaccinations among the group most vulnerable to adverse virus outcomes has dramatically slowed. It's a growing source of concern, not only because of the potential for preventable deaths and serious illness among seniors in coming months, but also for what it could portend for America's broader population. By government estimates, about 13 million American seniors have yet to receive their first shot. Even though they were the first age group prioritized for shots, more than 23% of those 75 and older have yet to be vaccinated. Supply constraints initially slowed the pace of senior vaccinations, but not for months for those in the high priority age groups. Instead, officials say, the slowdown is a cause of a mix of issues, from people having difficulty finding and getting to inoculation sites to vaccine hesitancy. Closing the gap will require taking into account all the obstacles for seniors, be they technological, transportation, or personal hesitance, said Sandy Markwood, CEO of the National Association of Area Agencies on Aging, who acknowledged the vaccination rates for older adults has somewhat plateaued. It's a potential harbinger of the challenges to come with other demographic groups. All adult Americans will become eligible for vaccination in the next 2 weeks, although the process of administering enough shots to begin returning to normal will take months longer. Many states, even as they throw open the doors on eligibility, are still maintaining priority vaccination systems or dedicated distribution channels to keep seniors who want the vaccine at the front of the line. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, has predicted that between 75 and 85% of the population may need to be vaccinated to reach herd immunity and bring an end to the outbreak in the U.S. That's one reason the White House and states have moved up to step up assistance programs for seniors and public education campaigns. Markwood credited the administration's $1.9 trillion rescue plan for providing funding necessary to go out there and do that more intensive, sometimes one-on-one outreach with seniors, saying it's that last mile, the last group who need the extra support. That's going to take the extra outreach and time. Even more help is on the way. Beginning next week, the administration is launching a $100 million effort to fund community organizations providing high-intensity support to at-risk seniors and those with disabilities through the Department of Health and Human Services. That includes assistance with booking appointments, traveling to vaccination sites, and other support through the vaccination process. Similar programs are already underway at the state level. Older folks are actually less hesitant than many. According to an AP poll in late March, 11% of Americans age 65 or older say they probably or definitely won't get vaccinated. That compares with 25% of all adults. A disproportionate number of unvaccinated seniors are from Black or Latino communities, or from people without easy access to health care, said Kathleen Cameron, Senior Director of the National Council on Aging Center for Healthy Aging, mirroring disparities in the broader population. And at least 6% of seniors are homebound. Those are the hardest to reach people, and those are the ones we need to work hardest to get to. either to bring them to vaccination centers or to bring the vaccines to them, she said. Okay, next up, I want to cover a story that has, I want to do it as sort of as a case study on the difficulty in communicating risk in public health. This from The Hill. CDC says risk of COVID-19 transmission on services 1 in 10,000. The risk of getting COVID-19 infection from contaminated services is extremely low, according to updated guidance published last Monday by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It is possible for people to be infected through contact with contaminated services or objects, which are called fomites, but the risk is generally considered to be low, the agency said. The principal mode by which people are infected with SARS-CoV-2 is through exposure to respiratory droplets, CD said. While not impossible, the agency said the risk of infection through fomites is generally less than 1 in 10,000. The CDC guidance, coming more than a year into the pandemic, is the strongest argument yet against what some critics have dubbed, quote, hygiene theater. Despite the fact that scientists at the CDC have been fairly certain since at least last spring that transmission is almost entirely through airborne particles, establishments have continued to insist on strict sanitation protocols, like constantly wiping down shared services with disinfectant and closing schools and subways for, quote, deep cleaning. According to the CDC, cleaning surfaces using soap or detergent and not disinfecting is enough to reduce risk in most situations. There is little scientific support for routine use of disinfectants in community settings, whether indoor or outdoor, to prevent SARS-CoV-2 transmission from fomites, the agency said. In public spaces and community settings, available epidemiological data indicate the risk of SARS-CoV-2 transmission from fomites is low, compared with risk from direct contact, droplet transmission, or airborne transmission. Disinfection is recommended in indoor community settings where there has been a suspected or confirmed case of COVID-19 within the last 24 hours, the CDC said. CDC director told reporters that other strategies being used, like fogging, fumigation, and electrostatic spraying, are not recommended at all as primary methods of disinfection because of other safety risks. Surface transmission can be reduced by wearing masks consistently and correctly, as well as proper hand washing, the agency said. Of course, this is slightly different than the hopefully new cultural norm of not shaking hand, you know, touching elbows or whatever, because if you're actually hugging somebody or shaking their hand, that's different than this fomite, which is an object that you touch and then somebody else comes later and touches. But this actually gets at one of my, probably in a year into the pandemic, this is probably my biggest pet peeve. It fits as a peeve that in reporting things like this, they use things like generally less than 1 in 10,000 and provide very little context. Risk transmission is difficult, but you really have to put it in context. This is a pretty good article in describing what they're trying to do, but particularly since the media, you know, puts that as the title, what does that mean? And it reminds me of the archetypal pet peeve of mine from former Vice President Mike Pence, who kept repeating over and over again, well, today you're really at low risk, of course, which is kind of a meaningless, inherently minimizing kind of statement that is not helpful to people. So let's look at that quote, generally less than 1 in 10,000. What does that mean? I think generally less is actually referring that, of course, you have to have an infection present in the environment to have any risk at all. So this is going to be dependent and relative proportional to the community rate of transmission. And now I want to participate in something that I would call bar napkin epidemiology, writing out a couple calculations on a bar napkin. Now, normally, if you have other efforts to do epidemiology, it's a lot better to do hard data. But this gives an idea, and it talks about the process and the context and the way that we have to think about these complex factors that are involved in transmission. So doing bar napkin epidemiology, if you haven't infected an individual and say they're infectious for about 10 days, it's about that. If they touch 10 high traffic surfaces per day, and then 10 other people touch those 10 surfaces in the hours after an infected person touched, you would have 10 days times 10 high traffic surfaces times 10 people touching each of those surfaces. 10 times 10 times 10 is 1,000. So if you have 1,000, but you have a 1 in 10,000 chance of getting infected by that, that would be a 10% chance of passing on the infection from an infectious person through these fomites, these other surfaces as intermediaries. Now, of course, it's probably actually lower than that, but that just gives you an example of kind of looking at all the factors that go into transmission. Now, the R-naught value, which is the amount of people that the average individual transmits to another person, it's around one, which means each person who's infected transmits to about one other person. So in this scenario, this bar napkin epidemiology, this would actually represent a 10% increase, a 10% chance of infecting somebody through these fomites, these other surfaces, as opposed to the way that they're saying is the most predominant mode of transmission, which is through aerosols. And that ends the first session of bar napkin epidemiology. Okay, well, moving out of the weeds and going to the big picture, this from the Hill. CDC director says racism is a serious public health threat. The CDC last Thursday declared racism a serious public health threat, becoming the largest federal agency to do so. To build a healthier America for all, we must confront the systems and policies that have resulted in the generational injustice that has given rise to racial and ethnic health inequities, the agency said. The declaration is part of a new agency-wide initiative called Racism in Health, which the CDC said is meant to be a hub for its research into the effects of racism on health and efforts to achieve health equity. And in a push for action, this from Stat News, Biden pushes Congress to boost public health pandemic preparedness funding. The Biden administration is asking Congress to bolster public health funding yet again, a call the White House says is necessary to prepare the country for the next pandemic and address public health crises that have been pushed amid COVID-19. Biden called for a $1.6 billion funding increase for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, a boost that represents almost a quarter of the agency's current budget, to help increase core public health capacity at the federal and state level. The money could also be used to help build out public health data infrastructure and train new public health experts. Biden also prioritized pandemic preparedness efforts as he proposed $905 million to buy new medical supplies for the nation's stockpile and increase organizational capacity at the Food and Drug Administration. That's in addition to the $30 billion Biden proposed in the first phase of his infrastructure plan for biopreparedness efforts. While the pandemic has consumed the public health world for more than a year, other crises have gotten worse, including the opioid epidemic. Accelerating drug overdoses could soon, for the first time, claim 100,000 U.S. lives in a single year. Biden is proposing $10.87 billion for research, prevention, treatment, and recovery support services related to the opioid crisis, a 57% bump from last year's levels. The opioid crisis has proved to be an ongoing political headache for the administration as well, as several Democratic senators threatened to vote against the acting FDA Commissioner Janet Woodcock if she were tapped for the top job over concerns about her poor handling of the epidemic. Other public health priorities Biden highlighted in his budgetary wish list include more than doubling funding for community mental health services, improving health equity and data collection on race and ethnicity, resources to lower maternal mortality rates, and funds to expand access to treatment and prevention of HIV and AIDS. Well, it's good to see that public health is getting some attention finally, though it's been a long, rough year to bring it about. Okay, well, moving from research to practice can be a long, long, hard road, but we have this from Medical Express. Implementation science should give higher priority to health equity. Moving scientific research results into public health and patient care more quickly could have significant impact on health equity, finds a new paper from researchers at the Brown School at Washington University in St. Louis. Implementation science is the study of methods and strategies that help to speed evidence-based practice and research into regular use by public health and medical practitioners. The rallying call for implementation science is that it takes 17 years for 14% of original research to reach patient care. This is sometimes called the biomedical valley of death, said Ross Brownson, a leading researcher on dissemination and implementation science. COVID-19 has revealed glaring and unacceptable inequities in the United States and globally, Brownson said. In implementation science, this is sometimes called the translation gap. The pandemic has also shown that when we mobilize political will and resources, we can speed up a process such as vaccine development that usually takes years and shrink that time frame to months. Implementation science offers a roadmap for addressing the systemic injustices in research and practice necessary to achieve population health equity. With an intentional focus on health equity from funders, researchers, practitioners, advocates, evaluators, and policymakers, the authors argue the United States could harvest the rewards of the resources being invested in health-related research to eliminate avoidable disparities, resulting in greater health equity. We can't just hope that science will lead to more equitable health outcomes. We need to do things differently, from the questions we ask, to the research partners we choose, to the way we define success. Okay, well, I'd like to take this point to put some surprising good news here. This from Medical Express. U.S. suicides dropped last year, defying pandemic expectations. The number of U.S. suicides fell nearly 6% last year amid the coronavirus pandemic, the largest annual decline in at least four decades, according to preliminary government data. Death certificates are still coming in and the count could rise, but officials expect a substantial decline will endure, despite worries that COVID-19 could lead to more suicides. It is hard to say exactly why suicide deaths drop so much, but one factor may be a phenomenon seen in the early stages of wars and national disasters, some experts suggested. There's a heroism phase in every disaster period, where we're banding together and expressing lots of messages of support that we're in this together, said Dr. Christine Mottier, Chief Medical Officer of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. You saw that at least in the early months of the pandemic. An increase in availability of telehealth services and other efforts to turn around the nation's suicide problem may have also contributed, she said. U.S. suicides steadily rose from the early 2000s until 2018, when the national suicide rate hit its highest level since 1941. The rates finally fell slightly in 2019. Experts credited increased mental health screenings and other suicide prevention efforts. The number fell further last year to below 45,000, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said in a recent report. It was the lowest number of U.S. suicide deaths since 2015. Okay, well, I've been trying to keep an eye on non-COVID deaths in the age of COVID that might be indirectly related to COVID, you know, with all the changes that we've seen in society with lockdowns and stuff. So this is really good news to see that we haven't seen a huge spike in suicides. And hopefully it'll bode well for our ability to be resilient and bounce back and actually maybe find some positive things that are mitigating some of the negative things about the era of COVID-19. Okay, I wanted to do a nice follow-up on a story I've reported on before in the last couple weeks about the U.S. banning potentially menthol cigarettes. This from Medical Express. Canada-wide ban on menthol cigarettes leads to significant increases in quitting among smokers. Bans on menthol cigarettes across Canada from 2016 to 2017 led to a significant increase in the number of smokers who attempted to quit, smokers who quit successfully, and lower rates of relapse among former smokers, according to a new research study from International Tobacco Control Policy Evaluation Project at the University of Waterloo. Menthol is the most common flavoring for cigarettes in many countries. Menthol creates a cooling sensation, which reduces the harshness of cigarette smoke. Because of this, menthol leads to increased experimentation and progression to regular smoking among new smokers, especially among youth. The positive effects of the Canada menthol ban suggest that a U.S. menthol ban would lead to greater benefits since menthol cigarettes are much more popular in the U.S. From our findings, we estimate that banning menthol cigarettes in the U.S. will lead to an additional 923,000 smokers to quit, including 230,000 African-American smokers. The harms of menthol cigarettes in the U.S. have been much greater among African Americans. Menthol cigarettes are smoked by 85% of African American smokers, almost three times the percentage of menthols among white smokers. The survey demonstrated three benefits of the Canadian menthol ban. Menthol smokers were significantly more likely than non-menthol smokers to attempt to quit after the menthol ban, 59% versus 49%. Daily menthol smokers were almost twice as likely than daily non-menthol smokers to quit after the menthol ban, 21% to almost 12%. And finally, those menthol smokers who had quit smoking before the menthol ban were significantly less likely than non-menthol smokers who had quit smoking to have relapsed back to smoking. Okay, U.S., let's see if we can follow Canadian lead. Okay, and lastly, want to close with a story from Medical Express. Cannabis almost as addictive as opioids among teens, study finds. Teenagers' addiction rates for cannabis are about the same as for prescription opioids, according to a new study of drugs in youth. A year after first trying cannabis, almost 11% of adolescents aged 12 to 17 met the criteria of addiction. Those in the same age group who tried prescription opioids had a similar addiction rate of about 11%, according to the study published in JAMA Pediatrics. The findings contradict widely held perceptions that cannabis isn't particularly addictive and may attract attention amid a broad U.S. push to liberalize its use. The rates of addiction were significant, especially since teenagers' brains are still developing, according to Nora Volko, an author of the study and current director of the United States National Institute on Drug Abuse. If users were younger when they first tried cannabis and other drugs, they were more likely to become addicted, the study found. For those in the 18 to 25 age range, only 6.4% developed an addiction a year after first trying cannabis, about half the rate of the younger age group. In the older 18 to 25 category, opioid addiction rates were similar to marijuana addiction rates after 1 year. Cocaine addiction rates were slightly lower. The findings underscore how important it is for doctors to ask teenage patients about recreational drug use, something that isn't always emphasized at younger ages, the researchers said. Emily Einstein, one of the study's authors, said a rise in cannabis potency in recent years could help to explain the higher addiction rates. She cited separate studies that have found marijuana with higher levels of THC to be more addictive. Recreational cannabis is spreading rapidly at the state level, and federal lawmakers are debating bills to legalize it nationwide. While states that allow cannabis restrict its use to those age 21 and over, some studies have found that more widespread availability in legalized states is linked to more use by young people. So this is a really interesting article, but I think one of the more general things that it brings out is that addiction rates are a function of both the chemical properties of a drug, like they talk about having higher levels of THC, plus the societal access and the mores of the culture. So addiction occurs in a context. And of course, that's what Just for the Health of It is here to do, provide you public health news and research in an appropriate context. Okay, for those of you who'd like to dig in a little bit deeper online, I've got some bonus articles that you can read, six of them this week. Brazil's become South America's super spreader event. Mentioned that one earlier in the show. Two, the big hole in America's plan to fight COVID-19 variants. Vaccine makers are studying whether booster shots or revised vaccines will be needed to fight new strains, but they don't have an easy way to expand production. Three, we are hoarding. Why the U.S. still can't donate COVID-19 vaccines to countries in need. Four, a year later, food workers still experience waves of COVID-19. More than 50 U.S. food and meatpacking plants have had repeated outbreaks of COVID-19, yet most workplace locations remain undisclosed. Five, in the COVID-19 vaccine push, no one is speaking Gen Z's language. And lastly but not leastly, six, foreign-trained doctors like me were asked to help fight COVID-19. Now we're being tossed aside. You can read these and all the other articles that I've reported on in this show at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.